Well, good afternoon, everybody. Giving Dan Meads, our in-studio guest, his last-minute positioning of the microphone as we get started on our show today. And he is our in-studio guest, Dan Meads, well-known anti-poverty activist. He's also the provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, I invited you in here because we had quite a week in our news last week, and that involved the violent death of a young man outside a home on Bond Street. And local residents, very thoughtful in their assessments of it all, but many of them saying, you know, we saw this coming. Something was going to give. And they expressed extreme concern about the, I guess, conditions in which the people in this particular home were living. And my understanding is that it was a for-profit emergency housing situation. Before we get started on that, I'm going to ask you, because you're face and eyes into this all the time, what does poverty and homelessness look like in Newfoundland and Labrador today?
That's a great question and a good way to frame this conversation, because when we talk about housing insecurity or homelessness or poverty, we want to really connect all of those things and understand how they're rooted in our communities. And so when we look at poverty rates here in Newfoundland and Labrador, specifically in St. John's, we're talking about rates at about 22%. That's much higher than the national average of about 14.5% or 15%. And so what that means for folks is that they're just not able to meet their basic needs each and every month. So they're making very difficult decisions based around whether to pay their insurance or pay their rent or buy food or diapers for the kids, these types of really basic decisions. Some of those individuals, through a whole bunch of reasons, some of them around addictions and mental illness, some around housing complexity and a lack of affordable housing stock, find themselves in some pretty insecure housing and some unsafe housing. And that seems to be one of the things that the residents of Bond Street were dealing with some of their neighbors. And so that's what poverty looks like in the province. We're looking at a relatively deep level of poverty. And so most of the people in Newfoundland and Labrador who are poor, so most of the people in that 22%, tend not to be really near the poverty line. They tend to be pretty deep in poverty. And those that had been near that poverty line seem to have fallen deeper into poverty over the last few years. That's a result of some of the economic impacts that we've seen. We've all seen our economy change. And it's also a result of some of the choices that governments have made around where to raise revenue, taxation structure, fees, those types of things. And so we have seen an increase in poverty, we've seen an increase in the depth of poverty, and then we've seen obviously some changes in housing security and housing insecurity in our communities. What we see when we look, when we dive into that homeless piece, and Homelessness St. John's did a point in time count just last year. And what that means is on one night they went and they literally counted everybody that was homeless in St. John's at that time. And they learned a bunch of things. You know, if you extrapolate that, they found that basically 180 people were homeless on that night. That was April 11th, 2018. But that's the bare minimum number of people that were homeless that night. And so that was counting people in shelters, sleeping outside, bus stations, what we call couch surfing, so staying with a friend in a precarious situation, those types of things. If you extrapolate that data to think, hey, what's the actual number of people who are homeless in St. John's at that time? The number's realistically closer to 800 people. It sounds like a lot as we stand here. It sounds like 800 people in our communities that are homeless. It sounds enormous. It's not a big number. That's a really solvable problem for Newfoundlanders and Labradorians to get their head around. It's just 800 of our neighbors who are homeless on one given night. That's a problem that certainly as a community and as a people, we should be able to figure out a way to get through.
Is it primarily focused on St. John's, or do we see similar types of situations elsewhere in the province, or is it because people tend to congregate or come to St. John's in order to find somewhere to live?
It tends to look differently based on which community you're in. Certainly that number is going to be highest in St. John's, and so especially around sort of shelter stays and what we consider to be rough sleeping, which are people that are just living outside, there are going to be more of those individuals in St. John's. But it happens all over the province, and so, you know, that's the place we counted because it's where the most services are and where the most people are. But there are people that are homeless all over Newfoundland and in Labrador as well. And, you know, there are shelters that are serving those populations as best they can all throughout Newfoundland and Labrador as well. So the problem may look a little bit differently in St. John's. It may feel a little different when you walk down Water Street and there's people panhandling, that sort of thing. But, you know, this is a province-wide problem. You're going to find people that are homeless or experiencing housing insecurity all over Newfoundland and Labrador.
You mentioned sleeping rough. Do a lot of those people end up sleeping rough?
No, thankfully. That tends to be less of a problem here in Newfoundland and Labrador, in part because of our climate. You know, February is a pretty tough time to be rough sleeping in Newfoundland and Labrador. And so folks do
so
try to
June,
find...
So June, for that matter, yeah, you know, with right. rain and everything else.
Yeah, and so we, you know, some other climates tend to see a lot more people sleeping outside. We certainly do see it, and not just here in Newfoundland, right? We see it in Labrador as well. But the prevalence isn't as high as it is in other places. You know, if you go to Vancouver and you see giant tent cities, that type of thing, we tend not to get that type of thing. Part of that is the scope of the problem, right? We don't have thousands and thousands and thousands of homeless people in our city. But it is also a function of climate, that folks have got to find a way to get in out of the cold. Otherwise, the results get bad pretty quick.
So back to what prompted me to give you a call in this situation on Bond Street. What are we talking about when we're talking about these emergency shelters?
Yeah, there's a set of important distinctions to be made here. So the shelter on Bond Street is a for-profit shelter. It's not providing services to those individuals other than a roof. And so if someone gets referred there or shows up there, they're able to stay there for the night depending on the circumstances, but there aren't any wraparound services, right? If we look at the difference between that and, say, transition houses, which is a group that I work with as part of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador, those shelters are specifically providing shelter to women and children fleeing violence. So that's the population that are served by those transition houses. And there's a full set of wraparound services with highly trained staff working around the clock to make sure that those services are provided in a safe, ethical, reasonable way, you know, here in St. John's, but also all the way up the coast of Labrador. The shelter on Bond Street is a very different thing than that. It is for profit, of course, and so, you know, and in this case, it was a per diem funded shelter, which meant that the owner of that house was charging the government of Newfoundland and Labrador per bed per night. And so that individual is incentivized to have people in the shelter. He's not incentivized to help people move on. He's not incentivized to help them find more secure housing. He's incentivized to make sure the people are in that bed every night because he can charge it out at $150 or $250 a night to the people in Newfoundland and Labrador.
And there's nothing wrong with that per se, if that's how the system is set up. But it doesn't help the people it's intended to help.
So I think we want to be really careful about what we mean when we say help people. Are those people better off in that shelter on Bond Street than they are under an overpass? Absolutely. Are those people, in some cases, do those emergency shelters find and enable people to move beyond that and advance up what we call the housing continuum to more stable, more secure housing? Sometimes that happens. But what we do see is oftentimes the individuals that find themselves in those shelters tend to be really high need. That doesn't mean that they're bad people. It just means that they have uncontrolled addictions or mental illness, or they have another set of needs that aren't going to be met simply by, you know, a bed and a warm place to sleep. That's the first need for sure, and that shelter is still providing that need. And we shouldn't say, hey, it's not helping these people, because it's certainly better than being outside. But it isn't providing the type of wraparound care that we see people needing in order to advance that housing continuum and to change the cycle of housing and homelessness that we do see from folks.
I have heard some of these for-profit landlords, for want of a better word, I'm not sure if there's, I'm using the right terminology here, indicate that, you know, if it weren't for them, some of these people would have nowhere to stay because they're unhousable.
In some cases, that's true. I hesitate to agree with the term unhousable. Everybody is housable. It just depends on the level of service and the level of commitment you as a community has to making sure that they're housed in a safe and appropriate way. They're not unhousable, but there are some gaps in our system currently, and I do think that some of these emergency shelters are filling those gaps. The other thing that I think is an important distinction to make in this conversation is that a lot has been made of the fact that these are for-profit shelters, as opposed to the nonprofit shelters that most of us consider homeless shelters to be. Certainly all the transition houses that I work with are nonprofits. All of them are, in fact, charities under the Charitable Act in Canada. And so it's a very different thing. But the fact that they're for-profit doesn't mean that they're bad. There are good for-profit shelters across Canada and some right here in Newfoundland and Labrador. The structure of the corporation isn't the important bit. It's whether or not there's operational standards and a service agreement with the Housing Corporation or the government of Newfoundland and Labrador so that we understand what our tax dollars are getting. We have a standard of service that we're happy with, and we want to make sure that people are provided with that level of wraparound care that they need. What we don't really want is for a company to set up shop, provide, you know, this housing, which is quite expensive, some of it $350 a day, and not be providing anything to change the nature of what that person needs or to help them really move along that housing spectrum. And so, you know, it's not that it's that they're for profit that's bad. It's, you know, in some ways, they're right. They're filling a need, which is that people are outside. They need a place to go. Some of these folks are exceptionally difficult to house. They're really complex in their needs. These shelters aren't meeting all of those needs, but they might be meeting the core housing need from a night-to-night basis.
Dan Meads, an anti-poverty activist and provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador, is my in-studio guest. We'll be back right after this. And our in-studio guest today is Dan Meads. He's an anti-poverty activist. He also is the provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador. And we've been talking about transitional housing, emergency housing. You work in the Transition House side of things, which is very different. We'll get into that in a moment. But first of all, I'm going to ask you, how does this transitional housing or emergency housing work?
So there's sort of two answers to that question. The first one is, in an ideal world, how emergency housing works. And we'll go there first, which is that if for any reason you find yourself in a community and you're unable to have a safe, warm place to sleep that night, there's access through a 1-800 number or other sources to find a really quick place for you to stay that's going to be safe and warm while you figure out the next steps to get you safe, secure housing and address any income issues that you may have, any of those types of things. That model is called Housing First. It's exactly what it says. Hey, let's get this person some stable housing first, and then we can deal with all the rest of the things that caused those housing insecurities. Housing insecurity comes from a whole bunch of different places, right? Like, it's really easy to think as a middle-class white guy that it's not an issue for me. But, you know, I leave the chip fat fire on and the house burns down, I got some problems pretty quick. Maybe I can find some family supports, right? Maybe I can't, depending on who's around me and what's happening. That's not meant to be a trite example. It's meant to help people understand that, you know, when we think about homelessness, it's really easy to think of it as something that's separate from where you are. But it really isn't that separate from your state of being. The folks that you walk past that are panhandling on Water Street have a background that's really similar to mine or yours or anybody else's in a lot of cases. And it's, you know, the course of their lives have made it really difficult for them to end up in the same place that some of us are. That housing sort of spectrum, that housing first model, basically says, hey, it's really difficult for anybody to address anything else that's happening in their lives unless the housing problem is fixed first. There's a bunch of organizations doing really good Housing First work here in Newfoundland and Labrador. Choices for Youth is doing some interesting Housing First model work, and Homelessness St. John's is coming at this work from a Housing First model. They're doing a great job. And there's been lots and lots of talk from the Housing Corporation and the government of Newfoundland and Labrador around a Housing First strategy. And I do think they're using a ton of great Housing First principles within that structure to try to help people move from emergency housing situations on that housing spectrum. How it happens functionally sometimes isn't as smooth as that ideal Housing First model. There are gaps in the system. There are, you know, it's a big, messy, complicated problem. And unless you've got a really big overarching strategy that's been well developed and matured over time, it's really difficult for every single person to have that ideal experience. And so what we're seeing now is lots of folks, especially in the urban centers, but also, you know, on the coast of Labrador in these really small communities where there just aren't a ton of services there. And so, you know, if there isn't any shelter space, if there isn't any affordable housing options, and someone ends up homeless for any reason, it's really difficult for that individual to find housing security in the short term, let alone find affordable housing in the longer term. Our transition houses throughout Newfoundland and Labrador are there to address that specific issue for women and children fleeing violence. That's the group that we work with, and that's the reason that we work with them. It's also really important that you note that I help work with that group, but there are amazing, remarkable women in small communities and large all throughout Newfoundland and Labrador running shelters and doing the hard work with remarkable staff every single day, and they're ready to pick up the phone 24 hours a day for women and children that are experiencing violence. And so if anybody listening feels like that information would be useful to them, they can check out our website, thanl.org, thanl.org, and they can find a shelter near them. So if you're a woman experiencing violence anywhere in Newfoundland and Labrador, that's a place to go to find a shelter that's available right now today to help you out. And so those shelters are there to help folks in that emergency situation. But if you're not a woman experiencing violence or her child, it gets a little bit tougher than that in some places. Even here in St. John's, it gets more difficult than that. And so that's how folks, you know, people end up homeless for a whole bunch of different reasons. People are unable to transition that way. And then there are lots of other opportunities for them to get emergency shelter. And you know, right now, that part of what prompted this conversation is that one of those gaps is being filled by these private for-profit shelters here in the St. John's area specifically.
It struck me as you were talking, but there, but for the grace of God, it could happen to any of us anytime, where we would find ourselves in a cavalcade of circumstances and all of a sudden, you know, everything becomes insurmountable. And in the end, if you don't have something to put in your belly and if you don't have a safe place to lay your head at the end of the day, nothing else matters.
Absolutely. It's really easy for us to think of this us and them attitude when it comes to poverty. And I have to tell you, I'm a really fortunate guy. I grew up in a middle-class household with two parents that worked really hard to make sure we didn't miss any meals at our place. But some of my neighbors weren't as fortunate. Some of the people I went to university with, I can think of a specific example. A dear friend slipped on the ice and hit their head, and their life has been very different than it would have been had that little accident not happened. And so I do think it's important to keep that in context. It was part of the reason I was so encouraged by the residents of Bond Street this week here in St. John's. They came out and said, hey, we've had this concern. We've talked to the police about it. We've talked to our community about it. We've talked to the homeowner and the landowner about it. These are our neighbors, and we're concerned about them. We're not saying this should be shut down and these people should be moved somewhere else. We're saying, hey, let's get a proper shelter that's going to provide wraparound services. And if you want to put it on our street, sounds good to us. Let's do it. I was really, really encouraged by that. Josh Taylor and Kelly Hickey specifically were out speaking to the media in these really thoughtful, open terms about how these are their neighbors. We want these folks to be able to be housed in a proper way that's going to provide some services. That's the right attitude, and it's what we really want to hear. They also weren't soft on the solutions, right? Some of those folks were calling for really big things from the government of Newfoundland and Labrador, calling out ministers specifically and asking for specific things. And I felt like it was really productive public advocacy work for those folks to do that.
Has government's response been what it should be?
Gosh, that's a tough question. Has it been what it should be? I have to be honest. I think the government of Newfoundland and Labrador is trying really hard to address this issue. I think they're taking steps every day. Is it a perfect system right now? It isn't a perfect system right now. But it's hard to just say, hey, the government's not doing its job on the housing file. I think when we look, the city of St. John's municipally is punching above its weight, as they say, on the affordable housing front. I think they're working really hard to do some of that work. I think the province is working really hard. And I think the Housing Corporation is doing a lot of work and kind of creating a lot of change around how they provide service. It's not perfect. There's more that can be done. Absolutely. And I don't love the price tag of some of this stuff either, right? $5 million directly to private shelters that aren't providing wraparound services. I don't love that price tag. I don't think anybody does. I think if you were to speak to anybody from government, they would say, hey, we'd like to move away from that model. And I think they're trying over time, and I think they will. So, nobody gets happier when someone gives them a microphone and says, hey, kick the government in the shins on what they're doing wrong on poverty and homelessness. I'm normally pretty eager to do it. But on this file, I just don't think it's necessarily their fault. I think it's a really complicated issue. I think they're working hard, and so is the community. There's nobody to blame here, really.
How do we compare to other jurisdictions in the way that we're handling these things? Are we doing okay, let's say, compared to Nova Scotia or Quebec or Manitoba,
right,
per capita?
Those are three super different answers. Basically, what you need to know is that in Canada, there's a giant spectrum of service delivery around housing and homelessness. Some communities in Alberta have functionally ended homelessness because they've had a 10-year plan to end homelessness. They've used this housing first model, and they've worked away at it every single day. Medicine Hat, these are the types of places that have ended homelessness functionally in their communities. It can be done. There are other places that have said, hey, we're just not too worried about the housing problem. We're gonna find other things to worry about, and we're gonna hope that if we grow the economy, that's gonna trickle down and make sure folks can afford housing. In those places, it hasn't worked so well. I mentioned Quebec. In Quebec, there's a ton of different poverty reduction type strategies that stop housing insecurity from being so dire to begin with. It's not that there aren't homeless people in big cities in Quebec. There certainly are. And there are giant shelters that are serving those populations as well. So how are we doing? We're doing not bad, is the short answer, especially on the housing front, because we do have the Housing Corporation that's working hard, and we do have, some municipalities are doing a lot of really good work as well. We're not doing so well on the poverty front. And that poverty file is what feeds into this housing insecurity. So when poverty rates are above 20%, way above the national average, when people who are living in poverty are living in relatively deep poverty, not living near that poverty line, that's why we're not going to see any changes in sort of the stream of people experiencing housing insecurity. As long as we don't address that issue of poverty, that emergency shelter based on income need is going to continue. As long as we continue not doing a great job on some mental illness and addictions issues, we're not going to be able to address that housing insecurity problem.
And I want to explore that a little bit more once we come back right after the break, right after this. And our in-studio guest today is Dan Meads. He's an anti-poverty activist, a provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador. And I guess on a daily basis, you're seeing and hearing stories of people who are living with poverty or struggling to come out of poverty. And we talked before the show, and I said, I'm going to talk to you about the poverty reduction strategy that was introduced a few years ago. And you said, can we set aside a little time for that? Because there's a lot going on there. So indeed, I'll ask you, the provincial government announced their poverty reduction strategy a number of years ago. And in 2012, they made a big deal about the fact that it was going really good. Is it working?
It was. The reason I wanted to take a little extra time to talk about this is because there are a few important stops along the way. You know, early on in the 2000s, Newfoundland had a poverty rate higher than it is today. And the depth of that poverty was really, really low. Our unemployment rate was high. We had some real big concerns. And then there was a poverty reduction strategy. Those of us that have been doing poverty reduction work for a long time have said for a very long time, poverty is a complex problem. It requires a complex solution. Unless you have a government-wide strategy to address poverty, you're never going to decrease poverty rates meaningfully and over time. Sure enough, the province of Newfoundland and Labrador heard that and constructed a pretty remarkably thoughtful and comprehensive poverty reduction strategy, and it worked. It was really great. At one point, Newfoundland was arguably the lowest poverty rate in the country. Prince Edward Island is a bit of an outlier on poverty sometimes, and so it's a little bit tough to get quite as low as PEI is sometimes because of their small population. The problem set seems to be a little more solvable there. But it was great. Around 2012, we had a really low poverty rate, down around 10%, well below the national average. And those that were living in poverty tended to be pretty close to the poverty line. And so with some service provision and a few other kind of policy alternatives, you were able to get people living functionally above the poverty line. That's changed a lot since then. Since 2012, we've seen an increase in poverty in Newfoundland and Labrador year over year. So a lot of reasons for that. Part of it is cost of housing. Part of it is the economic changes that we've seen in our provincial economy. And part of it is some of the decisions that were made around taxation and fee structure a few years ago in the provincial budget. What that provincial budget did was fundamentally increase the poverty line. And so when new taxes and new fees go on basic things that everyone needs, like driver's license and automobile insurance, those types of things, functionally it meant that folks that were just a little bit above the poverty line suddenly weren't able to make ends meet. What that means for individuals is not those difficult decisions, not just those difficult decisions we talked about earlier, but some really negative health and education and justice outcomes for our communities that tend to be really, really expensive. So you can kind of think of poverty as a binary thing. Either you're above the poverty line or you're below the poverty line. And if you're below the poverty line, you tend to have some pretty hard outcomes on education, justice, and health specifically. So what we've seen in Canada is that somebody that lives below the poverty line tends to have a life expectancy of 23 years shorter than someone that lives above the poverty line. So just from a pure compassion point of view, that's a huge difference in someone's lives. These are our neighbors and our friends that we're talking about here. The other thing to keep in mind in sort of a more cold-hearted view of this problem is that it's really expensive to have a bunch of folks that are doing poorly physically and that are having difficult interactions with the justice system as a result of poverty-related crime and that are putting stresses on our education system as well. So just from a cold-hearted point of view, it's not great for any of us to have so many people living in poverty. So the poverty reduction strategy worked. It was great. And then because there was a lack of commitment over time and a lack of renewal of those strategies and some changes in government policy, we've seen, as well as a bunch of other larger economic factors, we've seen an uptick. Those economic factors, right, are not just here in Newfoundland and Labrador. In the last few years, we've seen great changes in the Alberta economy, and that changes the way Newfoundlanders are able to make a living, as we all know. And so there's a bunch, it's a complex problem, and there's been a lot of things have fed into that increase in the poverty line, but we have seen it, and that's an important thing for us all to remember, is that, you know, some of the changes that we're seeing in our communities is a result of having more people that are struggling to make ends meet in our neighborhoods.
You talk a lot about the poverty line, but the question is, what is the poverty line, and is it different for different people?
It's different for different communities. It's not necessarily different for different people. There's a bunch of different ways to measure poverty. Some of them are really good. Some of them aren't so good. The national one that a lot of people use is called the low-income cutoff, or LICO. That's set by city size. Here in Newfoundland and Labrador, at the beginning of that poverty reduction strategy process, the government instituted something called the Newfoundland and Labrador Market Basket Measure. And that basically said, hey, what are the basic needs that someone has to live in our community? That's the basket. Think of it like a grocery basket. Everything that you need to buy in the run of a year goes into that basket, and you add it up, and that's what the poverty line is for that community. The result of that is that we get really granular data of what the poverty line is in different communities. We all know it costs a different amount to live in St. John's than it does to live in Gander, certainly different than it lives on the coast of Labrador or on the Burren Peninsula. And so keeping in mind that that straight poverty line, if one number for all of Newfoundland and Labrador isn't going to do us very much justice, and it isn't going to help us make good decisions when we think about public policy, but that there are different poverty lines for different communities. A rough number is just south of $20,000 a year. So if you really want to just have a number in your head to think what the poverty line is, you know, between $16,000 and $18,000 a year is what we tend to consider the poverty line to be. The functional poverty line here in St. John's is about $22,500. So
per individual?
Per individual, that's right. Now, you know, listen, good luck raising a family on $22,000 a year, right? What we're talking about there when we talk about the poverty line is just the bare minimum to try to scrape by. I'm certainly not suggesting that anybody making $23,000 a year is living high off the hog and sitting pretty. That's just not the facts of the case. But, you know, part of this conversation is, how do we decrease poverty? How do we measure it? What's the actual number? And so if we need to get our heads around an actual number, that's what it is for Newfoundland and Labrador today. That's not the best way to think of it, right? When we think about, we want our neighbors to be able to thrive. We want our communities to be able to grow and be prosperous. We want people to be able to have sustainable work that pays them a living wage and allows them to live with dignity and respect in our communities. And so those should be the real measures, right? How many low-income workers are in our communities? How many people are precariously employed? These are other really good measures of what we think of as poverty.
What sort of things keep you up at night? I know one of the main things that we've been talking about in Newfoundland and Labrador, and perhaps arguably one of the most important things that we have to deal with right now, is rate mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that bothers you with people on a daily basis?
Well, it bothers me as a citizen, for sure. It bothers me, you know, as a person who's got an old home in downtown St. John's that I've got heat like all of my neighbors. And so, you know, I'm also a person with a 4.5-year-old daughter. And when I look at her, I think, gosh, what's the future of Newfoundland and Labrador for her? And, you know, I've chosen to raise my family here. I've chosen to be hopeful about the future of our community and the future of our province, and I am hopeful about it. But, rate mitigation is a big problem. If you double people's electricity bills, that, once again, just increases that poverty line, right? And so folks aren't going to have a choice but to heat their homes in the middle of February. So what aren't they doing? What aren't they spending money on? What difficult decisions are they making in order to keep the house warm enough for the kids to get to sleep at night? And so, of course, it keeps me up at night. Of course, I worry about it. I think all of us do. The interesting thing about that problem specifically is that there's nobody in this province who's saying it isn't a problem. Everybody agrees that something's got to be done. And so I'm choosing to be hopeful. I'm choosing to think that something will be done before our electricity bills double, despite some of the evidence, maybe.
How do you compile your numbers? Because it strikes me as you're talking that, you know, there's people who come looking for help. There's people that you are aware of and you're having conversations with. There's other ways of keeping track of people. And there's lots of people who simply would never, ever in their mind own living would ever say, I'm in trouble.
Right. You know, I do think that distinction isn't as important to people day to day, right? And so whether an individual who gets up and goes to work at a low-income job and comes home and is struggling to make, the distinction of what the poverty line is just isn't that important to that person. But it is important to policymakers, and it's important to us when we think about how we vote in our elections, whether that number is important to us or not. It's important to me, and I tend to vote on what I care about in those ways, because I know what the impact is to my family and to those in my neighborhood. And that's the case all throughout Newfoundland and Labrador, right? If all of us as voters make poverty an issue, then the people we elect will make poverty an issue too. Doesn't mean we're always going to get it right. Doesn't mean the things that we think are the right answers turn out to do the right things down the road. But, I do think that that's an important thing. Where some of these stats come from, there's a great website hosted by the Newfoundland and Labrador government called Community Accounts. I suggest folks can go on there. You can search your actual community by community name, figure out what the poverty line is, what the market basket measure is for your specific community. It's really fascinating. It's laid out in a way that's really easy to understand. It's not in a big Excel spreadsheet. You can get charts and graphs to make it easy. And then also the low income cutoff is put out by Stats Canada every year. There's a few years of lag because of stats data. But you can go on the Stats Canada website and ask them what the LICO is, the low income cutoff is for your community size, and they can provide that to you as well. So if you're interested in this stuff, there's lots of ways to dig into it.
What makes you mad?
Oh, gosh. You know, I was really heartened this week by the community response at Bond Street. And so it's the opposite of that that sometimes makes me frustrated, when we sometimes have people in our communities all over Newfoundland and Labrador that get frustrated because they feel like the problem is in their neighborhood and all they want is that problem to go away to somewhere that they don't need to see it and deal with it every day. That's the most frustrating thing for me. Or when we get a response that isn't compassionate toward people. I find that really frustrating. I'm not sure how people feel that way, you know, how sometimes business owners are out there arguing for a lower minimum wage, and when business groups are doing that kind of thing, that kind of makes me angry. I'm also a small business owner. We pay all of our staff a living wage. I don't understand any business that chooses not to do it. Someone wants to have a racket with me on Twitter, that's the way to do it. When we have those reductive conversations about minimum wage and we ignore the impacts that it has on the staff, on employees, those are the things that frustrate me. And when we see communities that don't seem to care about the individuals as long as their neighborhood property values. And again, that wasn't the case on Bond Street this week, right? Like, we had some really thoughtful citizens come forward and say, this is a problem. We've been concerned about it for a while. Everyone seems to be trying. Here are some solutions we think might work. Can we talk about it? It was great.
You mentioned the city and how you said the city is punching above its weight. We saw the situation on Tessier Place not that many years ago. Similar kind of situation. Area residents very concerned about what was happening there because they could see that people weren't getting the help they needed, and there was an underlying other underlying elements there. Of course, it's not exactly the same, but is the city doing what it can when it comes to these kinds of situations?
The city's doing a lot. There's a few things about the city of St. John's that I think are really important to know. Number one, your city councilors are pretty accessible. If something you want to talk about, you pick up the phone, chances are they're going to return your call pretty quick and they're going to have something interesting or thoughtful to say. Doesn't mean you're going to agree with them all the time, but part of the beauty of municipal politics is that your councilors tend to be pretty accessible. And I'd encourage people to do that. Pick up your phone and talk to your city councilor about what's important to you. You know, End Homelessness St. John's has been hosted within the city infrastructure for a long time. That organization is doing some great work here in the capital city around planning, around pit counts. They've got a great community plan that they're reinvigorating right now. They're advocating for a housing first model, and they're directly delivering some pretty remarkable services as well. That's been hosted from the city. That's been supported by the city of St. John's, and that's a pretty remarkable thing. And the municipality also has quite a lot of city nonprofit housing that's providing direct services to individuals. I have to say, I think the city of St. John's is doing the best that it can. There's always room when I'm sitting down across from my counselor, of course, I don't say, hey, way to go, good job, and then not have any constructive comments to make. There's always more that can be done. But, you know, this is a tough problem, and I do think the city is doing a good job. Not every municipality in Newfoundland and Labrador is doing such a good job. And so if there's folks listening from outside the capital, what I'd suggest to them is, if when you're talking to your city councilor, one of the most important things to talk to them about, as mundane as it might seem, is zoning. It's got to be okay for us to provide services in communities, in municipalities throughout Newfoundland and Labrador. It doesn't happen everywhere. Lots of communities are really open and welcoming. But it's, you know, more than sometimes we see communities that say, emergency housing services, that sounds great, as long as it's on the other side of the bridge, away from my kid's school. And that's really not the attitude that we need. What we need are communities that are willing to provide help to their neighbors, and municipalities that are willing to stand up and say, hey, this is a provincial problem that happens here in the city, and we're going to do something to address it.
Dan Meads, the provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador, and an anti-poverty activist, is my in-studio guest. We'll be back right after this. Dan Meads, an anti-poverty activist and the provincial coordinator of the Transition House Association of Newfoundland and Labrador, is my in-studio guest. And what prompted me to give you a call this week, Dan, was what happened on Bond Street last week. And it not so much the incident itself and our condolences to the families associated with that, but the fact that people in the neighborhood were saying, you know what? We've been worried that something was going to give here. Something was going to escalate because they were so worried about the conditions in which some of these people were living. And that's a very fine distinction, isn't it?
It is. It's an interesting situation for those neighbors and community members to be in. They were, and still are, expressing concern about the quality of life of people living in their community. the fact that there was this terrible violent crime that happened on their street that cost the life of one of their neighbors, and they were all, you know, really open about the difficulty that caused to them as and sending condolences to that individual's family. They also weren't reductive about the problem. They weren't saying this happened because of housing insecurity. This happened because of poverty. They said, hey, there's a lot of contributing factors to this. It happens to be focused around this physical place that is an emergency for-profit shelter that's providing one service, housing, and not addressing a lot of the other concerns that are happening in these individuals' lives. And it's that sort of chaos that goes along with untreated mental illness and addictions and a bunch of other things, right? It's not, certainly not just those two things, that causes what has been a history of some violent crime on that particular street. And they were really compassionate in how they described that problem. You know, I do think it's really important that folks keep in mind violent crime can happen in any community, no matter the income level. You don't need to have a shelter in your community for something terrible to happen. It happened to be focused around some individuals that were accessing service at that shelter at the time. But, you know, it can happen in any of our communities. And I think, you know, the police force here in the city has done a pretty good job of trying to express that to folks as well and saying, hey, you know, this isn't an individual's fault other than the person who committed the crime. And so, I, you know, it was a thoughtful response all around. And I do think it's important for our community members and our neighbors to remember that, right? Like, hey, you know, this can happen in any community, not just one that has a shelter in it.
There is a concern, though, if somebody finds out that there's a certain type of property that's going to be used for certain things, there is a tendency for people to say, well, you know, what's that? I don't want my child to be near that, or I don't want it to be near my kid's school, or I have, there's some elderly people in this neighborhood, they're vulnerable enough as it is. Walk us through some of those fears, if you will, and how people approach them.
The most important thing for people to remember in this conversation is that a properly funded, properly administered service sector, so a housing shelter, emergency shelter, isn't going to change your property value negatively. It isn't going to increase crime rates. That's just not the pattern that we see in Newfoundland and Labrador. Your family's not at any higher risk if in your community there is a properly funded, properly administered emergency housing shelter in your community.
How can you tell the difference?
Well, you can do it in a lot of ways, right? I mean, you know, one of the beautiful things about the way we track crime, right, is that you can tell which communities are more violent than others. You can tell which communities have even higher rates of petty theft than you can in others. And what we don't see is a big red cluster of crime around emergency shelters. It's just not how it works. Certainly not our transition houses, right? What we see in our communities that have transition houses in them for women and children fleeing violence is that all you see in those communities is more access to important services for women and children that need them. And so, you know, if there's a conversation about whether or not there should be a transition house in your community or an emergency shelter in your community, the thing that you need to know then is that the people in your community that need help are going to have more access to help. Not that your property values are going to go down or that your kids are going to be put at higher risk. That's just not how it works.
I used to do tours one time with guests coming in on the cruise ships and that sort of thing, and I used to take them on tours around the city, and I would be telling them about this historic place or that historic place. And one of the questions that used to come up time and time again from some of the guests from outside of the country would be, where are all the poor people? Where do your poor people live? And a lot of them didn't seem to be satisfied with the answer when I would say, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know.
Yeah, sort of everywhere and nowhere is the answer, especially in St. John's. A lot of our downtown communities are really mixed. It's a little different when you get out into the suburbs, and it's a little different outside the capital city. But generally speaking, throughout Newfoundland and Labrador, we don't have ghettoized areas, thankfully. What we do have is really mixed neighborhoods. You know, I live downtown and, you know, houses just a short distance from my doorstep sell for a quarter of what my home did, and houses a short distance in the other direction sell for four times what my house did. And I think that's part of what makes St. John's such a wonderful place is that, you know, we are pretty well integrated. That comes from a history here in Newfoundland and Labrador of what we sort of colloquially call hard times, right? Like, you know, in my parents' generation growing up in St. John's, there wasn't anybody that wasn't poor in their neighborhood. Like living downtown St. John's, everybody was struggling to make ends meet. And so now the fact that some people aren't feels like a really big difference if you speak to my dad about this issue. Gosh, the fact that not everybody's poor seems unbelievable to him. And that's still part of the virtue of St. John's. And part of the reason we do see positive community responses to these things is that, you know, we do have a sense of compassion as a community in part because of our history, in part because of what we tend to think of as Newfoundlanders against the rest of the world. Like, of course, it's hard to live here. We're on a little rock in the middle of the North Atlantic. Yeah, it's tough. It's going to keep being tough. But if we pull together, we'll be all right. And that certainly is how I'm trying to think of this community.
It's interesting you say that, because I think about my mother, and she said, you know, we grew up poor, but we didn't know we were poor. Mm-hmm. Because everybody was on the same level.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my mom grew up in a little house on McKay Street with all her sisters and her brothers. And, you know, I don't think they were too hungry most of the time, but there wasn't a lot extra to go around. But they certainly never thought of themselves as being poor, right? You know, their father had a job at the brewery that he worked his whole lifetime and brought home a paycheck, and they were okay. And it's just interesting to think about what that means for our communities now and how that's changed when we have some individuals that are making an awful lot of money and are doing very, very well for themselves. And that's changed the cost of housing. It's changed the cost of everything in our communities. And it's made it very difficult for some of those that are living on the bottom end of the income spectrum to make ends meet when there is this higher income that's impacting the cost of some things.
What are we doing right?
Oh, gosh, all kinds of stuff. We're doing an awful lot of things right as communities. And so we're not ignoring this problem of housing. We're not ignoring poverty for the most part. We've got pretty strong voices on both sides of a lot of these issues. And so when we have employer groups come out talking about how the minimum wage is too high, we tend to have community groups and unions coming out and saying, actually, that's not true. And here's some data to say that, in fact, a higher minimum wage helps an awful lot of people. We don't tend to have a ton of people saying that we're overspending on poverty, or we're overspending on housing. The conversations within the House of Assembly and without tend not to be about drastic cuts. We are concerned about the fiscal situation in the province. I think all Newfoundland Labradorians are, whether you're elected or not. I think that's a concern for all of us. But when we have that conversation, we're talking about how to make things more affordable for people, not how to cut services for people. And I think that's a really healthy and productive way to have that conversation. It's not that there isn't room for spending cuts. I'm sure there might be. I wouldn't know where to begin in that conversation. But I do know that when we're having these conversations with politicians and with community members, we aren't hearing a great appetite for cutting services. We are hearing, hey, we've got to make sure the folks are taken care of while we address some of these bigger picture problems.
What's the biggest worry to people living either on the poverty line or just below it? Is it food? Is it housing? Is it
heat? It's housing. Yeah, it's housing. And all that goes with that. And so I do think rate mitigation comes into play there when we think about the price of electricity in the province. But it is housing, certainly in St. John's. And then the biggest problem outside the overpass, in my opinion, and we hear it through people that are coming through our transition houses all the time, is the lack of affordable housing options in rural communities. And so, you know, if for whatever reason you find yourself in insecure housing and you need to find affordable housing, the Newfoundland Labrador Housing Corporation units all tend to be full. And there just isn't anywhere for you to go for subsidized and affordable housing. Not every municipality is doing the work that St. John's is doing around providing some of those things. Some of the transition houses are able to provide some second stage housing units throughout Newfoundland and Labrador. That's difficult work. It's underfunded, and it's important work, but it's not in every community. And so that's what we're hearing the most in our shelters, is that, you know, the problem of violence isn't being addressed at its root cause. There's some work being done there, but it isn't happening. And there isn't anywhere for them to go. There's just not enough subsidized affordable housing throughout Newfoundland and Labrador for folks to leave transition houses and other types of emergency shelters and move forward.
Little under 2 minutes left. Final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Well, thanks for doing this. An hour on the radio is a long time to talk about these things. Part of the problem with poverty and homelessness is that these are big, complex problems, and it's really easy for us to reduce them down to little ideas and little solutions, when the truth is, even though folks that do my line of work, sometimes it's really easy for us to say, here's the problem and here's the solution. It's not that simple ever. And so having enough time to have this fulsome conversation, I really appreciate it. And the only other thing is to just make sure folks know that, you know, in your communities or somewhere near, in 11 places throughout Newfoundland and Labrador, there are shelters for women and children fleeing violence that are open 24 hours a day. They've got highly trained staff that are waiting to take your phone call and to try to make sure that you're safe and provide some supports to you. And once again, the website for people to find that out, thanl.org. If you go on there, you can find the shelter nearest you in Newfoundland and Labrador, and a toll-free number for you to call 24 hours a day for you to get access to one of those shelters.
Dan Meads, thank you very much for coming in today. It's a difficult conversation, I know, but an important one, and I really do appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for the time.
Tomorrow, we'll have St. John's Mayor Danny Breen as our in-studio guest, so be listening and tune in then.